Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. It was another night of protests across the country against President-elect Donald Trump. In Denver, protesters shut down I-25 for a half an hour. In Philadelphia, demonstrators carried signs that said, "Make America Safe for All."
And thousands marched in Portland, Oregon. Some lit firecrackers and smashed store windows. Portland police arrested nearly 30 people. Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley joins us now from Portland. Senator, welcome.
Well, thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, what do you make of what we saw overnight in Portland?
Well, it's a real tragedy. We've had three nights in which folks have come out to send a message to the president. It's been very peaceful and orderly, but last night there were some anarchists who acted otherwise, and they really take away the power of what thousands of people came out to say to the president, which is, quite frankly, please, as you take the mantle of the presidency, the leadership, quit tearing other people down. And real concern by all the folks he attacked during the campaign.
Is there anything that President-elect Trump could say to those people in the streets that could make this situation any better? Do you think he's capable of doing that?
I don't know that he is capable of doing that. He needs to get rid of his cell phone and quit tweeting stupid things. I think he needs to send a message that he's going to be looking out for the interests of all Americans and set aside some of the division and denigration that characterized his campaign.
Well, look, come January, you will have a Republican president. You will have a Republican-controlled Congress. You're going to have to work with these people who you have vast policy divisions on. What issues do you think you can work with a President Trump on?
Well, I think the one coming out of the box is infrastructure. And both of the major party nominees really emphasize that. And it matters a lot how it's done, of course. But this is something Democrats have been pushing for hard, and Mitch McConnell, Republicans, have been fighting against. So we can make common cause with the president.
Well, one area where I can foresee many, many struggles is with the Supreme Court. Now, this week you've said that the empty Supreme Court seat has been stolen from the Obama administration. What will the Democratic strategy be on a Supreme Court nominee that comes from Donald Trump?
Well, here is my enormous concern, which is that for the first time in history, the Republican leadership failed to fulfill their responsibility to determine if a nominee was a fit character or unfit character, as Hamilton characterized it. And this delegitimizes any nominee that Trump might put forward. Now, there's still time to salvage this. During the lame duck, we could hold the floor votes. If someone's voted down, that certainly has precedent in our history.
But the Senate leadership has already said it has no interest in getting Merrick Garland confirmed.
I think, yes, no, you're right. And I guess what I'm saying is we're facing a real problem that we're going to be taking forward in terms of legitimacy of whoever Trump might put forward. So we really have a deep corruption that is occurring through this stolen Supreme Court seat. So I hope it gets remedied.
But you do have an option. Democrats could use a filibuster to hold up a Trump nominee. Are you prepared to use it?
Well, certainly I'm prepared to oppose in whatever way I can. And someone who is illegitimate, doesn't reflect the values of America, doesn't believe in we the people. Of course, we don't have that nominee in front of us at this moment.
But you would filibuster the wrong nominee.
Oh, absolutely. We very much, when we changed the application of the rules back in 2013, we left in place the filibuster on the Supreme Court so that a president would not be tempted to appoint from the extremes, a Democratic president or a Republican president. But I think it's very important on the Supreme Court that we not have folks who are nominated from the very fringes of society.
Well, big picture, Senator, this election revealed some very big cracks in the Democratic Party, its failure to connect with white working class voters. But what's interesting is that you supported Bernie Sanders very early on, a candidate who was connecting very much with those voters in a way that was actually, in the end, kind of similar to the way that Donald Trump did. Do you think your party's at a crossroads after this loss?
Well, certainly there is a point we have to recognize, and that is for the last four decades, virtually all the new income has gone to the top 10% of Americans. And to the degree that Donald Trump is actually interested in working Americans, which there's nothing in his life history to suggest he is, but if he is, we're ready to work on that because that is exactly what we want to see as a foundation for all families to thrive.
Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Take care.
Well, more than 300 transportation measures were considered during this election, and on Tuesday, voters approved about $170 billion in public transit funding. Laura Bliss is a staff writer at CityLab, a part of The Atlantic. She covers infrastructure and joins us from New York. Laura, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy.
And three projects got a lot of attention. Let's start with the West Coast. Los Angeles County Measure M, which passed. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so this was exciting for LA County residents who care about transit. This was about $121 billion in taxpayer funds over the course of several decades that's going to be devoted to all kinds of things, including several new light rail lines, including a tunnel through the very infamously clogged Sepulveda Pass, where the I-405 runs, and also a number of extensions both rail and bus rapid transit to some of the less connected parts of the county, kind of in the southeastern regions. Also, sidewalk improvements, improved bus service on existing lines, better bike infrastructure. It really has the potential to transform the region over the next several decades.
And San Francisco's BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit, also got the support it needed for a $3.6 billion bond. But one of the biggest transit projects was in Seattle. ST3, what would that do?
Yeah, ST3. So this is a $54 billion initiative that got approved. This is going to come from sort of a variety of tax increases among Seattle area residents. And yeah, this is a major light rail expansion that's going to supposedly put Seattle sort of on par with San Francisco and Washington, D.C. as far as their rail connectivity, connecting several counties around the city of Seattle. So you really get a kind of regional system going.
And in Atlanta, a $2.5 billion proposal was approved to increase capacity and reliability for MARTA. That's the Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority. What about on the state level? There were 154 ballot measures on transportation. What were some of the big ones?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw plenty of states discussing bond measures and advisory measures like red light camera rules and, you know, talking about allocating funds towards building roads and highways. But some of the big stories were actually kind of about, you know, how are states controlling the funds that are going to transportation? So, for example, in California, this did not pass, but there was an initiative to get voter approval on state-issued infrastructure bonds of more than $2 billion. And that could have had the potential to actually stop some big infrastructure projects that are already underway. And then in Illinois and New Jersey, two initiatives did pass. They were both called transportation lockbox measures. And what these do are essentially like cordon off revenues from the gas tax and other sources that are really meant for transportation, but sometimes politicians draw on for other purposes. So this was sort of voters saying, no, we really want this money for transportation and transportation only.
What does it say to you that in so many places around the country, voters approved these measures to spend money on upgrading public transportation and at the same time elected a lot of people who are against doing exactly that? That if you were to poll Republicans in Congress, you probably wouldn't find very many who were big fans of spending money on public transportation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, transit in particular had this victory on Tuesday night, and it really does speak to this sort of divergent voting base, right? We do have these cities, even cities in states that went thoroughly red, right, saying, you know, we really want an urban future and we are willing to tax ourselves to pay for it. And absolutely, it is a story that runs counter to the votes that certainly propelled President-elect Trump to victory and really changed the tides in Congress. So, yeah, we do have this these two stories happening on the local and state and federal levels.
When you look around the country and all of the funding that has now been approved by voters to upgrade these public transit systems, if everything works as they plan, in 20 years, what's going to be a really standout system in this country?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, LA and Seattle certainly hope to be these sort of shining West Coast examples of cities that you know, once didn't invest particularly in rail and that kind of commitment to transit. But I think that they really hope to be leaders. And I think it will remain to be seen. You know, many of these projects do rely on pretty hefty federal matching funds. That's how their funding mechanisms are designed. So, you know, there is some question about what money is really going to come through for them, even with the sort of massive commitment that local voters have made.
That's Laura Bliss, a staff writer at City Lab, a part of The Atlantic. She covers infrastructure. Laura, thanks.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeremy. Pleasure.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is defending his social network against accusations that the company helped spread fake news stories in favor of Donald Trump.
I think the idea that fake news on Facebook, of which it's a very small amount of the content influenced the election in any way, I think is a pretty crazy idea.
Zuckerberg speaking yesterday at the Techonomy conference in California, where he said there was fake news distributed on both sides. Mike Berry joins us now to take a look at the social media reaction to Tuesday's election. He's head of audience at The Guardian US in New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. How are you doing, Peter?
Good, thanks. So Zuckerberg says it's crazy to say that fake news on Facebook played any role in the election. Do you buy that?
I do not buy that. The fundamental issue with Zuckerberg's position is that Facebook, at least the way that Facebook sees it, is a tech company. A lot of people are pushing from the outside on that and arguing that Facebook is a media company. And where this becomes really important is the fact that we have fake news and we have filter bubbles. We already know that every Facebook user is essentially their own editor for their news feed.
Right.
What they click on and what they interact with defines what they see and also can define what their friends see. When you take this and you essentially remove editorial standards from it, you essentially take the filter bubble that exists on Facebook and on other social platforms and you weaponize it. You turn it into essentially a way of transferring information through your personal networks because you're your own personal editor.
Right. So in your opinion, I mean, what does Facebook need to do to filter out this fake stuff or to improve the filter bubble?
Facebook needs to get braver. They need to understand that if they put down editorial standards, that isn't necessarily providing a filter. It's simply giving a rubric for people to understand the difference between what they're reading when it's true and what they're reading when it's not verifiably true.
Mm. Well, in this election, there's also Twitter. There seems to always be Twitter this election season. Donald Trump apparently got control of his Twitter account again after his advisors reportedly got him to stop tweeting in the days leading up to the vote. But again, controversy already after Trump tweeted last night that the protesters who've been marching across the country against him are being unfair. How's that playing out?
Well, it's a really interesting dynamic. We already know that the @POTUS Twitter handle is going to be handed over to President-elect Donald Trump when he becomes the president in January.
Hmm.
The question is if he's going to let go of the real Donald Trump Twitter handle. It's become an enormously powerful force for him to get his message out. The difference is that the real Donald Trump Twitter handle is that of a private citizen.
Mm.
The @POTUS Twitter handle is that of a public official. And as we know with President Obama, his tweets are going to be archived. Is Donald Trump going to use his personal Twitter handle to bypass, you know, these kinds of public records? Is that even possible?
Do you hold out any hope that his tone will change once he gets in the White House?
I think that the proof is in the pudding, and we haven't seen much pudding yet, but the pudding that we've seen is that Donald Trump is going to be the exact same kind of communicator that he was as a candidate.
And to be fair to Donald Trump, he did come back a few hours later after this protest tweet to say that he loved the fact that a small group of protesters have such passion for the country. But I also want to talk about some other things we've been seeing buzz around on social media. There was a video of kids holding up a Trump sign in a hallway of their school in Pennsylvania. You could hear them saying white power. And on the other side, we've seen a video that appears to be from the west side of Chicago showing African Americans beating up a white man on the street. And you can hear someone in the background there yelling, "You voted Trump," which, it seems like if we needed any reminder that there was a dark side to our country right now, social media is reminding us of that.
That's absolutely true. And it's something that we see in, you know, more traditional tragedies. What makes this different is that This isn't an attack. These are people recording specific experiences and understanding that this is a part of the new paradigm in which we live. So the question really becomes, are we going to be treating these as two competing narratives? Are we going to be talking about how there are anti-Semitic, racist, misogynistic harassment across the country and define that as a single narrative and then have a competing, equally understood narrative that there is anti-Donald Trump sentiment? That's an argument that's going on social media, throughout the press, and among regular people on a daily basis as to, you know, how are we going to understand what is going on? What are the forces at play here? And how are we going to figure out a way to talk to each other and understand each other?
Mike Berry, head of audience at The Guardian US, thank you.
Thank you as well.
Well, people who live in sober houses are less likely to start using drugs or alcohol again. But the privately owned group homes aren't regulated in most states, and some don't enforce sobriety rules, which can jeopardize the safety of the people who live there. Ryan Karen King of Here and Now contributor WNPR reports on an agency that's trying to improve conditions in sober living homes across Connecticut.
Ken Oligata walks through a house in the quiet, picturesque neighborhood of Clinton, Connecticut. This is a privately owned sober living home called Right Path House, where seven people with addiction currently live in recovery. Oligata of the nonprofit Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery wants to make sure it's a safe environment.
Yeah, everything's squeaky clean. There's no drippy faucets. There's no mold. There's no dripping in the shower. Water pressure normal.
Right Path House has agreed to this voluntary inspection. If it passes, the house will be listed in an online database of certified sober houses. Oligata is hoping to make it easier for people with addiction to find a place to continue their recovery after rehab.
Everybody needs a home, you know? Everybody wants a safe home, so, and that's what we're looking for, and that supports recovery.
Right Path House is run by Lisa Ferguson, who also lives here in recovery. She opened the house a year ago with the hope that her niece, who was also struggling with addiction, would live here.
Unfortunately, she didn't make it. And she died January 4th of this year. And I tried to get her into this house. That was another motivation, because this would have turned things around.
Ferguson says her niece died of liver failure, and she says she might have qualified for a transplant if she had lived in a sober house. Ferguson now wants to give other people with addiction a safe, supportive environment for recovery. Most importantly, she says, the residents here are required to stay sober. And if they relapse, they have to leave the house and go back to rehab.
You didn't get in your bad situation in 28 days. It took you a long time to get there, so it's going to take you a long time to learn the life skills to get out of it.
But privately owned sober houses are unregulated, and experts say not all enforce sobriety rules. And that puts other residents at risk for relapse and sometimes fatal overdose. There are also state-funded and regulated recovery houses where people with addiction can live. But it can be difficult to get into these programs. At Right Path House, Ferguson, a former school teacher, includes meditation, yoga, and art sessions in her residents' daily schedules. But the extensive care comes with a price tag of up to $6,000 a month. There are cheaper houses to live in, but some have been found to be unsanitary and overcrowded.
If someone's charging you $140 a week for a room, they do not care about your sobriety and your well-being.
Jack Malone oversees the operation of two state-regulated halfway houses in nearby New London. He says many privately owned houses in the city are just in it for the money.
I get it. I understand it. But you can't be saying, well, I'm going to have a house for sober people, because what that engenders is real bad behavior. This is a chronically relapsing disease.
New London is tackling what they call the Wild West of sober houses by bringing in Ken Oligata's voluntary training and certification program. They say they're the first city in Connecticut to do so. But so far, none of the 30 or so sober houses in New London have gone through the certification process. State legislators have tried to crack down on private sober houses. Last year, a bill that would require a sober house to register with both the town it's in and the Department of Public Health was proposed, but it died in committee. Oligata estimates there are well over 200 sober houses in Connecticut, and he's working to certify about 50 homes across the state. Oligotis's part of a sober house's success hinges on alerting the community from the beginning that they're going to be a good neighbor.
We want you to know that we're going to open up this house soon, and we're going to have an open house, and we're going to have cookies and milk, and we want you to come down and see what the recovery house is and how it operates and all the support it has for its clients.
Oligotis's demand for sober house beds is high. When Right Path House opened last year in Clinton, the surrounding community not only was supportive, but two neighbors silently battling addiction just a few doors down requested to move in. For Here and Now, I'm Ryan Karen King.
We want to take a minute now to note the passing of Canadian singer, songwriter, and poet Leonard Cohen, who died yesterday at the age of 82. In addition to performing his own songs, Cohen wrote for Judy Collins, James Taylor, Willie Nelson, and many others. He was perhaps best known as the writer of the haunting Hallelujah, covered by many artists, and he was active right up to his death. In fact, if you were listening to this show last week, you would have heard him. His new album was featured in our DJ sessions. This is You Want It Darker, released just last month to critical acclaim.
Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the help that never came. You want it darker. I'm ready, my lord.
Leonard Cohen, who died yesterday at 82. This is Here and Now.
There's a lover in the story, but the story's still the same. There's a lullaby for suffering and a paradox to blame. But it's written in the scriptures and it's not some idle claim.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
While thousands of people are taking to the streets across the country to protest the election of Donald Trump, in California, some voters are taking their discontent a step further with the Yes California campaign, which calls for the state to secede from the U.S. Joining us now to explain is John Sepulvedo, host of the California Report at Here and Now contributor KQED. He's in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this hashtag CalExit is all over Facebook, all over Twitter. What's it all about? Who started it?
Well, it's a very good question about who started it, but this is because it really traces back to a group of Silicon Valley investors from almost 10 years ago. This has been an idea for a long time, and it simply boils down to this. If California is not wedded to federal regulation, some of the things that Silicon Valley wants to do and some other industries want to do, they might be able to have more luck at trying. Now, the CalExit and what's being called CalExit on this website that's up, it lays out what seemingly is a very convincing plan for California to secede. They cite the 10th Amendment as part of the reason that they'd be able to secede. They explain how California's debt would be better, how about $16 billion worth of taxes from California leave the state to subsidize other states like Mississippi and Alabama. What they don't talk about is how much California gets in return. There's a lot of trade protections, and they really don't spend a lot of time on that. So it's been very interesting to watch because, Jeremy, when you look at this, at the end of the day, it is a very similar argument to what conservative states were making after the election of President Obama, citing the 10th Amendment, citing the right to self-determination. We had the same thing happen in Texas in 2009, and we seem to have forgotten that.
Well, and it never actually happened, which is another important point here about whether this is even possible.
Yeah, it does not seem possible. But then again, many people did not think that the election of Donald Trump was possible. And so that I think it's really important, you know, as a journalist, I think this is kind of where we come in, because a lot of these stories are appearing in people's Facebook feeds and people are hashtagging it. This is a small fringe group that is funded by very wealthy people who have a lot to gain if somehow this was to happen. And generally in our system, if there are winners, there are losers. And we're not talking a lot about who may lose in such a Cal exit.
Who is against this idea?
One of the people who is against this idea is Tom Steyer. He's a big billionaire activist. He's mentioned often as somebody who may run for governor as a Democrat. And he said this.
The whole so-called Cal exit is something that is an absolute, that is a last resort when everything else has failed, when you believe that, honest to goodness, there is no ability to move forward as a nation.
So clearly we have somebody who has been able to make a lot of money himself, who think this is a really bad idea. And, you know, just a few years ago, I was hearing very progressive people express outrage when supporters of Ammon Bundy and other extremists on the right were saying that they should secede in parts of Washington and Idaho, Montana, Nevada. And now many of them are calling for the same thing.
That's John Sepulvedo, the host of KQED's The California Report, talking with us about the idea of California seceding from the U.S., gaining some support in the Golden State. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's a long tradition of writing about war, and veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are the latest to add their work to that tradition. Here now is Alex Ashlock reports.
War can generate great literature.
Those other wretches, how they bled and spewed, and one who would have drowned himself for good. I try not to remember these things now. Let dread hark back for one word only. How, half listening to that sentry's moans and jumps, and the wild chattering of his broken teeth, renewed most horribly whenever Crumps pummeled the roof and slogged the air beneath. Through the dense din, I say, we heard him shout, I see your lights, but ours had long died out.
Part of Wilfred Owen's poem, The Sentry, read on the BBC. Owen was killed in action on November 4, 1918, only a week before the signing of the armistice that ended World War I. But other wars took its place. The late James Salter flew more than 100 missions as a fighter pilot during the Korean War. He based his 1956 novel, The Hunters, on that experience.
Aces are pilots who have downed 5 airplanes. They are champions. There were 39 American aces during the Korean War. Their immortality was not as great as believed. At least one was himself shot down and killed. Others died afterwards in crashes. Many of the aces were squadron, group, even wing commanders, men often in the lead, aggressive and bold. A small red star painted on the side of a pilot's plane, just below the cockpit, was a symbol of a kill. Discreet, almost invisible in the air, a row of 5 was a mark of highest honor, greater than any trophy or prize.
The Vietnam War was the first conflict we watched on television. It was personal. Tim O'Brien was a foot soldier in that conflict. His book of short stories is called The Things They Carried.
On ambush or other night missions, they carried peculiar little odds and ends. Kiowa always took along his New Testament and a pair of moccasins for silence. Dave Jensen carried night sight vitamins high in carotene. Lee Strunk carried his slingshot. Ammo, he claimed, would never be a problem. Rat Kiley carried brandy and M&M's candy. Until he was shot, Ted Lavender carried the Starlight scope, which weighed 6.3 pounds with its aluminum carrying case. Henry Dobbins carried his girlfriend's pantyhose wrapped around his neck as a comforter. They all carried ghosts.
Actor Bryan Cranston reading from The Things They Carried. Today, soldiers carry laptops and cell phones into war, and troops who fought in Afghanistan and Iraq are adding their writing to the literature of war. Many of them found a home for their work on the New York Times website, writing for a project called Home Fires. The editor was Peter Catapano.
I found that the theme that was most consistent was this sense of being an alien in their own land when they returned, and this kind of disconnect that they felt between themselves and those who had served and, you know, the rest of the American population.
One of the writers featured on Home Fires was Phil Cly, a Marine and Iraq War vet whose book, Redeployment, won a National Book Award for Fiction in 2014.
I was trying to invite readers in to imagine these experiences from the inside of the heads of different people at different times in Iraq, because it's so intense, not just what you experience when you deploy, but also coming back home, what America looks like after you've been at war and what you make of it. And I think it's a really important conversation to be having.
Another vet who also fought in Iraq, Brian Turner, has been a major contributor to that conversation. His recent war memoir is My Life as a Foreign Country. But he's also an award-winning poet. Here he reads his poem, To Sand.
To sand go tracers and ball ammunition. To sand the green smoke goes. Each finned mortar spinning in light. Each star cluster bursting above. To sand go the skeletons of war, year by year. To sand go the reticles of the brain, the minarets and steeple bells, brackish sludge from the open sewers, trash fires, the silent cowbirds resting on the shoulders of a yak. To sand, each head of cabbage unravels its leaves, the way dreams burn in the oil fires of night.
Home Fires also featured Roy Scranton. He was deployed to Iraq in 2003 and 2004. His new book is a novel called War Porn. It's told from different points of view, including an American soldier in occupied Baghdad and an Iraqi math professor who's taken prisoner and tortured. I spoke to Scranton in downtown Boston earlier this fall. Did you come up with the title?
I did.
What does it mean?
What does it mean? So war porn is a term used to describe videos often or pictures brought home or sent home by soldiers of bodies or atrocities or shooting people or just violent things happening. As the title of the book, it means that, but it also it has a broader meaning to include the photographs from the Abu Ghraib scandal, which factor into the book and the writing of the book, and also just the idea of war as something that we look at. Like, I wanted to really foreground the voyeurism in war narratives and war literature and the way that audiences approach, the way that American audiences approach the stories that veterans bring back and the stories that we tell ourselves about war.
And you mentioned pictures, and part of the book, as you said, is an Army veteran who comes back home, and he's at a barbecue, an end-of-summer barbecue, and one of the guys there is really interested in what he did during the Iraq War, and what he really did was he was involved in torture.
That was a really important part of those first few years of the Iraq War, and I'm glad to have the novel coming out now when it does, because I think we've forgotten about that moment. I think we've forgotten that there was a time when the United States government chose torture as state policy, and it's important for us to remember that. And in some ways, for me, I think it's symbolic of the whole Iraq War in a certain way, just the way we went about it, the condescension and ignorance with which we, the U.S., went into this, you know, sovereign nation and this other culture.
Iraq War vet Roy Scranton talking about his novel, War Porn. Laura Wesley is a West Point grad. She also served in Iraq. Her memoir is called War Virgin. She writes about trying to live up to the expectations of an abusive father and the challenges she faced as a woman in the military. There's also a lot of sex.
I never would have expected for war and for combat to be a very sexually charged environment. And looking back and really understanding my emotions, especially after writing this memoir, I completely understand how fear and thinking that you might die can be so intertwined with sexual arousal and the need to feel connected to someone on such a deep level. But that's something that I would have never imagined, and I want people to understand that. I want the civilian population to understand that so they can better grasp what soldiers go through, but I also want anybody who's considering a military career to be aware that that could happen.
Your military service is obviously a huge part of your life, and it's a huge part of your memoir. But what did it mean to you as a writer?
It gave me something really important to write about. because if I didn't have the military experience, perhaps it's been in me all along to become a writer. And I know with future writings, the next book that I want to write, it's not going to include military service, but I do want to touch on being a veteran. There's so many other things I want to write about, and it's not going to cover the military. And I think, and this is probably because of the way I was programmed by my father and programmed, conditioned by the military, I almost feel like in order to take on any kind of endeavor, I have to have something special to validate that. And that's not right. I think that any artist or anybody pursuing any kind of career should be able to do whatever they want to do. But to me, it gave me like a legitimacy to become a writer. It essentially gave me permission to become a writer, and it gave me something really unique to talk about.
Iraq War vet Laura Wesley. Her memoir is War Virgin, My Journey of Repression, Temptation, and Liberation. The poet Brian Turner also reflects a veteran's journey to and from war. His poems are signposts on that trip.
Poems are a way for me to kind of wander back into that sort of headspace of that time. The poems that I've written after the war are about the war as well, but I'm trying to learn from my war experiences how to write my way into the rest of my life.
It's a soldier's eternal quest, coming home. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
The stock market is flat today after two strong days following the election of Donald Trump, but there are still many details to learn about Trump's plans for the economy. Joining us now is Larry Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton and President Emeritus of Harvard University. He also served as one of President Obama's chief economic advisors. Larry Summers, welcome back to Here and Now.
It's good to be with you, Jeremy.
So first of all, what's your reaction to this, to Trump being elected as the next president of the United States?
Like most, I'm astonished, very surprised given the data as it appeared to be coming up to the election, and in a broader sense that someone who had expressed many of the views that he expressed and approached people and approached groups within our population in the way that he had could be elected as president of the United States. So I'm certainly surprised.
What do you make of the market reaction? The Dow futures fell when the news kind of became clear that he was going to be the next president. But then the market has been shooting up the last few days.
Not what I would have expected, and it's not what, judging by the pricing of options, markets expected. Markets have made a judgment, which might be right or might be wrong, that his substantial commitment both to large-scale infrastructure spending and to the removal of regulatory burdens from many companies will have a substantial reflating effect on the economy. But, you know, immediate market reactions to events like elections are very fickle as guides to what is going to happen. It's famously said that the stock market has predicted 12 of the last five recessions, and something similar can be said with respect to booms. Hmm. So I think it would be a mistake to judge too much from this immediate market response. What will be crucial is the content of the economic strategy that's pursued going forward.
And one of the things that we know is that it appears the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is not going anywhere now. And Donald Trump has said he wants to renegotiate NAFTA. What do you think that will mean for our economy?
Look, I think the effect of the announcements he's already made has been to drive the Mexican peso down by 10%. And that means that every good exported from Mexico to the United States is 10% cheaper, and every good exported from the United States to Mexico is 10% more expensive. And so I fear that those adverse effects will exceed any possible benefits from renegotiation. And I think it's a broader point if one looks at emerging market currencies generally, they have been downwards pressured by the news of Trump's election, and that potentially will have an adverse impact on the trade position of the United States and on the very workers he professes most strongly to want to help. So I think we need to be very, very careful in our approach to international economic policy. I think the instinct that Donald Trump has to a substantial increase in infrastructure spending is correct. I think the impulse to reform of the tax system is correct, though the details he appears to favor do not seem to me the right ones. But I think the impulse to lash out at the rest of the world is a potentially dangerous and destabilizing one for the global economy.
And what about the impulse, and he's talked about it, to get rid of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms that were put in place after the financial crisis? What do you think that will do?
Looking at the regulatory regime and looking for excesses, looking for errors where there's a need for further adjustment, those are always the right thing to do. But if he is suggesting that there should be the wholesale repeal of major new measures to protect consumers from predatory mortgages, major measures to assure that derivatives do not become, as Warren Buffett called them, weapons of mass destruction, major measures to assure that banks are better capitalized than they were coming into the crisis, if that all is to be abandoned, it would be to invite a recurrence of 2008, and it seems to me would be a catastrophic error.
That's Larry Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary and President Emeritus of Harvard University. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.